KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. New Mexico this week moved to a county-by-county system for responding to COVID-19 that allows local communities to reduce some restrictions on mass gatherings, restaurant dining, attendance at religious services, and some non-essential businesses if the virus retreats. But as the new rule went into effect Wednesday, only one of New Mexico's 33 counties, Los Alamos County, would be eligible to ease restrictions on gatherings and resume indoor dining at restaurants. Over the past week, about one in every 155 people in the state was diagnosed with COVID-19. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham announced counties will be sorted into three distinct categories, red, yellow, and green, to determine their reopening eligibility. The state will use the average test positivity and the per capita incidence of new COVID cases as a metric for considering whether a county qualifies to move categories. Counties in the red will be the most restricted, as they are considered to be extremely high risk. According to Grisham, only one county currently qualifies to move from red down to yellow.
The whole state, except for Los Alamos County, is in the red. Los Alamos is yellow. This is startling, but it's not where the story has to end. We can show this map in a couple of weeks. It can be yellow. There can be some counties that are green. We can move through it fairly quickly and effectively if we really all do this as productively as we can together.
Grocery stores in red counties will continue to operate at 25% of maximum capacity, or 75 customers, whichever is smaller. In yellow counties, maximum occupancy will be expanded to 125. One change from the current public health order: counties in the red will now be able to resume outdoor dining at 25% maximum occupancy. Indoor dining will remain shut down until a county qualifies for the yellow category, where restaurants will be able to operate at 25% capacity indoors. Grisham says the state will update the county-by-county framework every 2 weeks.
The goal isn't to be moving through these all the time. The goal is to be steadily moving towards green, and then what I hope to be talking about, green plus, which means that we've really learned to manage to live with the virus, and we can open up many more things in a more reasonable fashion. Businesses are counting on us, and New Mexico lives. We deserve, all of us, the opportunity to save as many New Mexicans as we can.
State Human Services Department Cabinet Secretary Dr. David Scrace announced the state has 16 ICU beds. He says many patients are being treated in converted outpatient facilities.
We've shown a 45% increase in cases over a 14-day period. But more disturbing than that, we've seen a 89%, almost 90% increase in hospitalizations and a 60% increase in deaths. These two numbers are disproportionate to the growth in cases, so we're watching that.
Scrace attributed New Mexico's stay-at-home order with helping to curb the number of cases reported over Thanksgiving weekend, though expects another rise in cases during the coming weeks due to holiday gathering. The governor says one of her main concerns is having enough medical staff to care for COVID patients.
The issue isn't so much today that we have no space for patients, even though we are seeing them in hallways. The issue is staffing. You can't staff all of these outside locations. So we've been dedicated, as you know, to figuring out, right, step-down care and other situations because we are at a critical point.
Grisham stressed the need for New Mexicans to follow all public health orders, highlighting the loss of Las Cruces teacher Sylvia Garcia, who recently passed away from COVID, as a reason to take the fight against the virus seriously.
We lost a beloved educator just recently from Las Cruces. I talked to her family members. It's incredibly painful. No one's going to make the decisions to put anyone at risk if we know we can't manage, mitigate, and to the highest degree possible, nearly eliminate it, because we're doing so well at minimizing the ability of the virus to be prevalent in our communities. It is the only responsible, meaningful, productive way forward.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
As COVID-19 cases grow, patients are sometimes being transferred out of state. Hospitals are just overwhelmed, and hospitals that are accepting patients want to make sure public safety guidelines are improved across the country. More from Madeline Beck of the Mountain West News Bureau.
Our region is facing a hospitalization crisis. COVID-19 patients are flooding ICUs, adding to an already busy time of year. To tackle it effectively, hospitals and states need to work as a team, but as the Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck explains, it's not that simple.
In Washington State, the frustration is palpable.
For our healthcare workers to be having to put themselves at risk for residents of states who are not following the best science is exceptionally frustrating.
That's Cassie Sauer. She's the CEO of the Washington State Hospital Association, and she's mainly talking about Idaho. Over the past several months, Washington State has followed stricter public health protocols than many Mountain West states, including a statewide mask mandate. Most recently, it's gone into another lockdown with the current surge. Meanwhile, in Idaho, there's no plans for a lockdown, and while some local ordinances require masks,
we are seeing noncompliance with these local orders.
That's Governor Brad Little in one of his regular pandemic pressers. Little's response to this noncompliance is not to institute a statewide mask mandate, and he says law enforcement officers can't be everywhere. Instead,
this comes down to personal responsibility.
Still, Idaho is among the top states for infection rates, and some hospitals are running out of ICU beds. Back in Washington, Cassie Sauer believes her state is picking up the pieces. An increasing number of Idaho patients are showing up there, and she says some hospital managers are pushing back.
One of the hospital leaders said, we do not support extending an invitation to send us more.
But an unfunded federal mandate from 1986 says larger hospitals must take critical patients from anywhere if they have room. If they don't take the patients, they face steep fines. Mashita Beer says there's more at stake than fines, though.
We have to work together because you don't know who's going to be next, and that's really the reality of it.
Abir is an emergency doctor at the University of Michigan and a policy researcher for RAND Corporation, a nonprofit think tank.
Today it may be Detroit, tomorrow it may be Grand Rapids.
She says resentment and feelings of not wanting to treat people across the border are a manifestation of something else. The stress and mental fatigue of watching people die while citizens and politicians refuse to listen.
Because I think at the root of not wanting to take care of people from across the border is mental health issues, is stress, is kind of having it, you've reached your limit.
Abir says we need to figure out how to work on a national scale. Stop the state-by-state bickering like we saw with PPE and ventilators early on in the pandemic. She says we need a national plan so hospitals aren't pitted against each other for a pool of limited resources.
We have to really realize that the pool is narrow, but not everyone is going to need all those resources at any given time. So there's definitely plenty of room for sharing and collaboration.
And she says it's critical for governments to use money and recognition to incentivize hospitals, which may be competitors, to work together now to save as many lives as possible. Ian Hunter sees the need for collaboration. He's chief of staff at Sheridan Memorial Hospital in Wyoming.
COVID is so hard.
Right now, he says he can send his trauma patients to Billings, Montana, but they have no beds left for his COVID-19 patients. Still, the hospital is working to help him with those patients in other ways.
We do telemedicine with them. So daily we have consultations where they can help us manage some of our sicker patients.
As a small hospital, he said they never expected to be caring for patients who were this sick. Hunter expects infections in his county to continue to surge, and as the public health officer in the county, he ordered a mask mandate. Not his state governor, though. Mark Gordon, like Idaho's governor, continues to rely on personal responsibility and local governments, even while he recognizes the crisis.
When you see Eastern Idaho Regional Medical Center close their hospital, that's a problem. When you see Billings Clinic close their hospital, it's a problem. When South Dakota has to send their patients to Wyoming because they're too full, that's a problem. And when we have capacity issues down in Colorado, that's a problem.
Moving forward, every state in the Mountain West projects COVID-19 rates will climb and their healthcare systems could be overwhelmed. Some Utah facilities are already rationing care, and that's even before we see the fallout from Thanksgiving. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
Funding for the Mountain West News Bureau by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Well, Republicans have traditionally called for local control instead of putting the power in state capitals, but that's not the case with pandemic restrictions. Just the opposite. In Texas and elsewhere, states are preventing local communities from creating safety rules. Texas Tech Public Media's Sarah Self-Walbrick reports.
Sherry Rose tried to go to a local craft store this past weekend. She thought she could quickly run in for a few things while she was taking care of other errands.
As soon as we turned the corner, the parking lot was just packed.
She didn't stop at the store and kept driving.
You would have thought it was a Black Friday. There were so many cars. This is ridiculous. How can we be having so much COVID problems and people are packing the stores like this?
Rose isn't the only Lubbock citizen thinking this. Concerned commenters have flooded social media about specific businesses they don't think are following occupancy and masking rules. County Judge Curtis Parrish says officials are doing what they can to enforce statewide rules, but he says the protocols in place don't allow for them to do much. He gave an analogy.
If you're speeding or you're not wearing your seatbelt, then the cops can pull you over, give you a ticket. There is no mechanism like that for this mask order or even a large gathering order.
Local level leaders across Texas have voiced similar frustrations. The El Paso County judge tried to issue a countywide shutdown because he felt the state mandates weren't doing enough for the virus-ravaged community. Texas courts said he couldn't do that. El Paso is just one example. Parrish says communities should be able to better address local problems.
I would like to see the governor's office turn over some of the management of this disaster back to the local authorities. I think we know what's best and how best to handle this.
But at a news conference in Lubbock, Texas Governor Greg Abbott said that is unlikely to happen. He wants local officials to enforce what's already on the books.
Some local officials are not using the tools that are available to them to make sure that they are taking every step they need. So just giving more tools won't mean anything.
The tools Abbott is referring to are outlined in his most recent executive order. It allowed for further reopenings after the spring shutdown, as long as an area's hospitalizations remain low. Lubbock has been considered a region with high hospitalizations for over a month now. Parrish says Abbott has made one thing clear. He wants to manage the pandemic from Austin.
One of the issues that I've had with the governor from the beginning is that one size doesn't fit all. What's good for Harris County, what's good for Dallas County, is not necessarily what's good for Lubbock County.
Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor at the University of Houston, says the blanket approach to reducing coronavirus spread in Texas goes against the decentralized political system.
Allowing for local control just makes more sense. The resources are there and it's available for those officials to be on the ground talking to people and really trying to stop the spread of the virus.
Rottinghouse notes that at the beginning of the pandemic, local governments had more power. He thinks the state level leaders were worried about the economic impacts of restrictive municipal shutdowns, so they created orders that superseded local ones. Now, local officials have to make those work.
The best the counties can do is to engage in dogged enforcement of capacity limits and mask mandates and just good old-fashioned moral persuasion that people should do the right thing and protect each other.
Because of Lubbock's high hospitalization rate, restaurants and non-essential retail stores should be operating at 50% capacity. And the statewide mask mandate is still in effect. The Lubbock Police Department fields calls about businesses and people not following the rules. Police spokeswoman Allison Matherly says the number of those calls has decreased. At the beginning of the pandemic, they could get 20 to 30 complaints a day. Now it's more like a handful a week. I'm Sarah Self-Walbrick in Lubbock.
Another aspect of COVID-19 now, health officials say that residents in New Mexico have waited in longer lines for COVID-19 testing and are waiting several days or even several weeks for results as coronavirus cases surge throughout the state. The Department of Health says the longer timeline is happening because more people are being tested. That puts more strain on labs and increases delays for results. The state's 7-day average daily testing number was recently more than 12,000 compared to 5,000 tests a day earlier in the pandemic. In depth, once again, here's Madison Staten.
On the day KRWG visited the New Mexico Department of Health Southwest office, the line for COVID-19 testing went out of the parking lot and down the street. It's a familiar scene due to the rising cases within Doña Ana County, but New Mexico Department of Health Communication Director Marissa Mays says the department has expanded testing to meet the need.
In southern New Mexico, they have some of the counties with the highest rate of spread. And so the good news is that people are testing, and testing is filling up quickly. There are sometimes we've received phone calls for people saying, you know, I tried to log in and register to test and it was full. I tried the next day and it was full. That is why we're expanding the testing. We've expanded testing hours. We know that those lines can be long at times. We know that people are waiting for quite a while, and we are so grateful that they're sticking it out and doing the right thing, because it can be hundreds up to thousands of tests depending on where you are a day.
Don Sanchez, the Southwest Regional Public Health Director for the New Mexico Department of Health, says nurses serving in the Las Cruces office each average between 25 to 30 tests per hour. She estimates the office averages a wait time between 45 minutes to an hour and a half.
And we typically have 4 or 5 nurses here in Cruces testing. Sometimes we're lucky we have some nursing students and BCom students come help. So that really helps move the line a lot quicker. So a lot of it just depends on the staffing we have available. You know, the number of cars that show up that day. Mondays are always a busy day. It's interesting. Monday and Tuesday are the busy days of the week, to be honest with you. And then it kind of evens out over the week.
Sanchez recommends registering online before coming to the testing site. Despite the increase, she says her team has been able to continually get the testing equipment they need.
Originally, we were ordering, I think, about 2,000 test kits. We're using those per week. That was early when this whole thing started. We're up to about 6,000 now. So we're able to get our supplies, though, very quickly and keep the operation going.
The rise in cases is not only impacting testing, but also hospitals with capacity concerns. One solution to rising COVID cases is sending patients to alternative care facilities, like Haciendas at Grace Village in Las Cruces, a nursing home that is providing space for senior COVID patients to recover. Marissa Mays says the facility offers hope during a time when hospitalization rates are climbing.
That is going to help take a burden off some of the hospitals, because that is designed specifically for patients who need step-down care. So they're not ready to go home, or they're not in a safe environment where they can, so they need a safe place to recover.
Memorial Medical Center's Chief Medical Officer Dolores Gomez recently spoke to KRWG about the merits of alternative care facilities and says her team will continue to work with the community to find solutions.
There are people that maybe aren't as sick and don't have to be in the hospital. How do we build locations outside of the hospital, alternate care sites to continue to care for these patients, but maybe it's just done in a different facility with maybe not as severe as a sickness in those patients as well. So we're working with our community, working with our city and our county to look at that as well. So that way we don't ever want to say we can't give you care.
Gomez emphasized the importance of following public health safety measures, wearing masks, practicing social distancing, and following all state public health orders.
A lot of people talk about, you know, thanking the healthcare workers because we're the front line. You know, honestly, we're not the front line. We're actually the last line of defense. If you're reaching our doorstep, we're the last line of hopefully getting people through things. Really, our community is the front line right now. This is a public health issue. This is nothing more than that. And it's all about prevention. And how do we prevent others from getting ill? We do the things that you hear over and over and over again. And I don't think you can repeat it enough. We need to wear those masks.
Southwest Regional Public Health Director Don Sanchez is also calling on the community to meet the moment. Sanchez recognizes the struggles many are facing, but says people must take action to keep everyone in the community safe.
This is is a point in time in our lives. It's a challenge. You know, I'm hopeful this time will pass. But right now it is time to do the right thing and follow those public health orders, because it only is going to save you. It's going to save your loved one. It's going to save your communities. One of my staffers gave me a quote, but he said, breathing through your mask is uncomfortable for everyone. Breathing through a ventilator will be unforgettable to your loved ones.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Well, in the new year, we will see a new face updating residents about the state of COVID-19 and other health issues. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham has chosen Dr. Tracy Collins as the new Health Department Secretary. Collins, who leads the University of New Mexico College of Population Health, recently talked with KUNM's Megan Kamrick.
Dr. Collins steps in as the state is seeing an explosion of coronavirus cases that threaten to overwhelm the healthcare system. She brings an expertise in health disparities that have been exacerbated by the global pandemic. Collins says her interest in healthcare began when she was young.
I was born in the Bay Area. I lived in Fremont and Oakland for the first 13 years of my life. And then my dad, he worked for General Motors. At the time, they were opening a new plant in Oklahoma City. So he moved us to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, just before I started high school. And so that was a major change for me as far as moving from California to Oklahoma.
I can imagine.
Exactly. I went from a place with, you know, having diverse friends, African-American, Latino, Native American, Asian American, and then suddenly it's like you're black or white in Oklahoma. Things have changed since then, but when we moved there, it was really a drastic change socially. And so because of that, I went from being like a cheerleader, outgoing, to just studying because I was otherwise not enjoying the social interactions. So as I began to study more, I then developed a group of friends, a little network, and we would provide sort of comfort to each other about navigating being in Oklahoma and understanding how to survive. And with that, you know, I began to enjoy chemistry. And I talk with my chemistry instructor. Now I'm in high school. I'm like, what can I do with chemistry? I mean, what kind of careers are there? He's like, well, you could become a chemist. And he says, or you could go to med school. And I was thinking, that could be an option for me. And so that was one sort of, this might be what you think about doing moment. Another for me was when my mother had a major illness and she wasn't getting good care. They thought that she was drug seeking. And as an African-American woman, she kept showing up with abdominal pain. Well, as it turns out, she decided that because she couldn't get good care in Oklahoma, that she was going to go stay with her older sister, who was the head nurse at a hospital in Monroe, Louisiana, which is where my mom is from. But on her flight to go to Louisiana to be with my aunt, during the layover, people noticed that she looked a little dusky and she was moaning and groaning and that she just didn't look right. So they had the ambulance come and pick her up, and she had emergency surgery. So she had a small bowel obstruction from something that's a rare or slow-growing tumor called a carcinoid. And that was the reason for multiple trips to the ED to try and get help. And they thought she was drug-seeking when, in fact, she did have something underlying that was causing her pain. And had they listened to her, the outcome could have been different. But we were basically forced to drive back and forth every weekend from Oklahoma City to Denton, Texas. That's where her layover was as she tried to get down to Monroe to see her, because she had about six surgeries and it took her about 3 months to recover. And then that was the initial recovery. Once she got back to Oklahoma, it was still a prolonged course, but she began to get better. But it was just, for me, I thought, if I ever become a physician, I'm going to do my best to listen to my patients.
And how did you decide to move into healthcare policy?
Yeah, so as I was finishing up my internal medicine residency in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I really enjoyed seeing patients, but I really wanted to have an impact on how we deliver care. So I talked with some folks and I learned about a general medicine fellowship. And at the time, there were two big programs, Johns Hopkins and Harvard. I was fortunate to be accepted into both programs and decided that I loved Boston, so I decided to go to Harvard. And so that experience gave me exposure to how we determine what are efficacious treatments. So getting a master's in public health and then learning more about educating the future workforce and continuing to see patients. And so that was my initial move towards policy. And so as I grew my research career and moved from Boston to Houston to Minnesota, and then down to Wichita, Kansas to chair a Department of Preventive Medicine and Public Health, it was during my time there that I decided I wanted to further my education a bit more. And I learned of the program at Dartmouth, the Master in Healthcare Delivery Science, which is a combination of an MBA and a health policy degree. And so that was my sort of indoctrination or my exposure and training to do even more, even though my Harvard degree was excellent. My degree as an MD from OU, University of Oklahoma, was very good. I think that was solid training, but the policy piece was kind of missing. And so I feel like now that I've had training at Dartmouth, I'm prepared to really begin to look at policy issues and make a difference in that way.
Your story about your mother is infuriating and tragic. So she was treated essentially as a drug addict when she had something actually wrong with her. As you moved through getting your degree and moving into practicing medicine and then into policy, how much did you see that your own individual experience was replicated systemically?
Unfortunately, I saw it more than I wanted to. I mean, good examples of that are patients with sickle cell disease who are in crisis and they're in pain. And oftentimes they have to really struggle to receive pain meds because they're perceived as seeking drugs. And there are studies out there that have highlighted that your race and to some extent your gender will influence how a physician might perceive you when you're in pain and how likely they are to actually prescribe narcotics to help you. Now, we are on the other side of this whole opioid epidemic, and there are issues there, but minority patients in general, from persons from communities of color, are typically perceived as drug-seeking when, in fact, they actually have pain.
How did you migrate into population health? Was that all of a piece of what you were focusing on with your degrees?
It was. You know, as I've done research looking at peripheral artery disease, exercise, getting people to walk to improve their lower extremity function and how far they can walk. You know, one of the pieces of that is to understand what are some of the barriers that patients might experience to getting good exercise, to eating right. And it's really those upstream factors, those social determinants of health that really influence health outcomes. You know, we think about healthcare delivery, and it's very important. But it's really about 20% of that formula that really determines health outcomes. At least 60% is really influenced by the social determinants of health. So as I was at Dartmouth finishing up my master's in healthcare delivery science, I started to think about, you know, preventive medicine is important, but population health and really making a difference in the social determinants of health is important to me. And it's going to matter for me if I'm going to make a difference as a clinician, as a public health practitioner. So that's how I got interested in population health, because I see it as a partnership between public health and healthcare delivery.
Give us a definition of population health. I shouldn't assume people know what that is.
So population health really is the intersection of multiple disciplines, typically public health and healthcare delivery, to improve the outcomes of diverse communities, to really understand for various communities throughout any region, what are the driving factors that are influencing your health and what do we need to do to improve health outcomes? And what, so you pull in social work, you pull in healthcare delivery, MDs, health professionals, you pull in public health practitioners, and we design the interventions. We look at the data that influences how we understand your health. And then we come up with interventions to improve health outcomes. So population health is really a multidisciplinary approach to improving the health and health outcomes of diverse communities. Population health is really how we're managing this pandemic right now. And we could do better, but it's really, you see public health, the messaging about what we need to do, the distancing, the hand washing, the mask, how that can help to reduce the burden on the healthcare system. So it's a partnership.
What brought you to the University of New Mexico?
So I learned of the position to serve as dean for the College of Population Health. And UNM, very progressive under the leadership of Deborah Helitzer and many others, started this college in 2016. It's the second such college of its kind in the U.S. and it's the first to offer a bachelor's program in population health. So as I was thinking about what would be next for me in my career, moving from a chair of a department, I was really looking at dean positions and I was very interested in population health. So when I learned of this position, I thought, wow, I definitely want to go and learn more about that opportunity. And so that drew me here.
And how have you helped guide the COVID work at UNM during the pandemic?
So the college we have, we're fortunate to have some really great epidemiologists. So many of them were engaged early on back in April and May with reviewing the data and giving information to the state to understand what needed to be done to help us contain the virus. Me personally, I've been working on making sure that we are addressing the needs of the university around reopening and keeping students safe, students and faculty and employees. So understanding what we need to do around testing, contact tracing, and making sure that we have an environment that can quickly react and actually proactively prevent exposure to COVID-19 for our students in residence halls and employees.
The pandemic has had a disproportionate impact on communities of color and low-income communities where people either can't work remotely or they lost jobs in the economic turmoil. How do you plan to guide the COVID response in the state with those realities in mind?
Yeah, we have to balance keeping people safe with keeping the economy going and providing a safety net to support the most vulnerable. So when we think about frontline workers, now we have healthcare workers, we have persons in housekeeping, we have grocery store workers. We really need to see about keeping them safe so that they can work. So making sure they have the proper mask, that they can cover their eyes, that we're providing them with what they need to remain safe while they're still working. So I think both things need to happen. It's really safety, but also keeping the economy going. Because as you've mentioned, it's communities of color that have been hit hardest by this. So when we think about N95s, we definitely want to make sure our healthcare workers have those. But there are other workers who also would benefit from having those, restaurant workers and the face shields or goggles, because the virus can be, you know, you can contact it through your eyes. So it's not just your nose and mouth. You also need to protect your eyes.
And New Mexico was really doing well for a long time in controlling the virus spread. Now we're seeing record case numbers that threaten to overwhelm our healthcare system. Do you have a sense of why this is happening and how much DOH or other state agencies can help bring it back under control?
Yes. You know, as we look at the data, you've got the shopping, you've got private gatherings, and most recently looking at sort of dining indoors. And so what we have to do is figure out, okay, let's at least try and contain this for at least the next 2 weeks, and then figure out how we can open up businesses, other entities safely while keeping people from contracting this. So the private gatherings, if we could get people, I know this is so difficult, we're all tired of COVID, but if people could hang on through this holiday season and refrain from having large gatherings and, you know, keep minimize the number of people to your home circle, the people you live with anyway, that's going to help us. And just minimizing exposure, don't get out and about unless you have to, unless you have a doctor's appointment. And if you can do that via telephone, if you can, and wearing your mask, distancing, good ventilation in your home, all of these things can help.
There's been a real challenge in this pandemic with public health messaging, and there's so much misinformation. Do you have some thoughts about how we can more effectively message for people to understand how serious this is? I've been reading stories over the last week of, you know, these poor nurses in ICUs treating dying patients who are either full of regret that they didn't take this seriously, or they're just angry that it's real. And there, I just, something's not working and I don't know what we can do.
You know, it's an excellent point, and it almost requires sitting down with the people who are convinced that this is not real and having a dialogue with them, because, you know, we have the messaging out there. If you drive down the highway, there's messaging about, you know, wear a mask, 6 feet apart at least. People need to realize this virus is serious. We've lost nearly 250,000 Americans. And even if you've not died from this, you could have long-term complications. It's not a benign situation. Now, the people who recover, good for them, but that's not everyone. There are people who really suffer, and then losing a loved one. So you're right. We definitely need to continue to identify ways of getting the naysayers engaged and helping them understand, you know, we really need to come together on this. And if you're not worried about your health, I'm sure you're worried about your pocketbook. So at the very least, the more we can do to wear masks, to de-densify, you know, space where people are, where it's enclosed, the better off we'll be. And that's for everyone. This is not ideological. This is not about a certain political party. COVID could care less about who you are or what you think. It's there and it's real.
One of my colleagues recently needed to go get a test, and I, over the past 2 months, have gotten tests, and it had been fairly easy to register the same day, go to a DOH site, get your results in about 24 hours. She had to drive all the way to Santa Fe last week to get a test. I'm wondering if that's happening, what we can do to ensure that we have robust testing and contact tracing.
I think we're in a good place right now with testing, but, you know, as the cases grow, our needs are going to grow. And so I think with the new administration coming in, although we really don't want to wait till January, more work is going to have to happen. I actually have been tested twice, and I was fortunate to get my results within 24 hours, and I didn't have to wait. So obviously we're in a situation right now where more people are being tested and the needs are growing, and we're going to have to adjust to meet those needs for sure.
What are some of the other things you hope to work on as DOH secretary?
There are issues around cannabis. There are issues around sites, long-term care facilities. There are a lot of needs that I'm getting up to speed on. And as I move into the office, I will know more of what I need to focus on. Fortunately, I have people who've been there for quite some time now who I can work with, some really great people who'll be working to get me up to speed on the things that we need to address. There's border health issues. There's a lot to do, and it's kind of diverse.
Dr. Tracy Collins of the University of New Mexico College of Population Health, she spoke with KUNM's Megan Kamrick. Collins is the choice of Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham as the new Health Department Secretary for the state of New Mexico. Of course, you can get the latest news on COVID-19 anytime online at the region's homepage, KRWG.org. KRWG News This Week, I'm Fred Martino. Thank you for being with us. Sticking with health news, a new federal grant is helping researchers at Western New Mexico University better understand how nanoagrochemicals may play a role in the future of agriculture. To learn more about this research that could help address food insecurity, Anthony Moreno talked with Dr. Ilya Medina, Assistant Professor of Chemistry at WNMU.
Dr. Medina, thank you so much for joining us for the program to talk about this research.
Thank you for the invitation.
First, if you could share with the audience, what are nanoagrochemicals?
Well, nanoagrochemicals are part of nanotechnology, which is, you know, lately a boom. Nanotechnology involves the study and the application of materials that are at the nano size. When we talk about the nano size, these are way smaller than conventional chemicals or materials that are in the market. The nano size materials have dimensions between 1 and 100 nanometers, which is about the size of a virus, right? So that's for you to have an idea of how small these materials are. Nano agrochemicals are just chemicals that are manufactured in these small sizes with the idea of being more efficient for agricultural practices.
Share with us a little bit about the research.
Yes, here at Western New Mexico University, we recently got a U.S. Department of Agriculture grant to study the application of different nanomaterials for agriculture. The idea behind this is that we want to look at these different materials. We're testing zinc-based materials, copper-based materials, manganese-based materials, silicon-based materials, and we want to use them as nano-fertilizers, nano-pesticides, right? We want to see if these materials can work more efficiently than traditional agrochemicals. So right now we have four undergraduate students performing research in different crops. We are testing corn, bean, pea plants, jalapeno plants. And the most important part of this is that we're using local soil from here in Silver City. And this is important because we are trying to rescue those soils that are left behind for agriculture and see if by using these agrochemicals, we can actually use soil that no one is looking at.
Tell us a little bit more about where you think this research is going and what you've discovered so far.
Well, recent studies have shown that these nanomaterials are more efficient than traditional chemicals. And this could be beneficial in terms of cost, right? Because we're gonna talk about using less amounts. And most of the agrochemicals that are used in agriculture end up lost either in the air or in the soil, but the plants don't really take them. The hypothesis behind our research is that these nanomaterials are so small that are gonna be easily taken up by the plants. So they can be used faster and more efficiently. Of course, the idea is to reduce the cost, but also enhance crop productivity and the production and the nutrition of the product should be improved as well.
Agriculture producers are, I'd imagine, very interested in research like this, especially when you're talking about cost and efficiency. We also live in a time where food insecurity is becoming a major issue, not only across the globe, but in our state of New Mexico. How do you see this type of research playing a role with food insecurity?
Well, actually, that's the main motivation behind this research, right? We know that it is estimated by 2050, we're gonna have a food shortage because of population growth and of course, climate change. So a lot of the soil that used to be used for agriculture is not suitable anymore. So that's why we are looking at this, because we are trying to use land that cannot be used anymore by recovering it through the application of these nano agrochemicals. We're also looking at fighting stress in the plants. You know, salt stress or drought stress can be fought easily and better with nano agrochemicals. So in general, this should improve food production, not only in New Mexico, right, but as you say, in the globe.
Dr. Ilya Medina, Assistant Professor of Chemistry at WNMU, we appreciate you taking the time to share this fascinating research.
Thank you.
Business News Now, and Virgin Galactic has been selected to provide regular access to flights for NASA payloads as the space agency conducts more research and development and plans for exploratory missions. NASA announced the partnership this week, saying that the flight and integration services will benefit the agency's flight opportunity program managed out of Edwards, California. Virgin Galactic joins other companies with similar commercial contracts with NASA. The agency says the contracts are worth a combined $45 million. Virgin Galactic is preparing for its first test space flight from Spaceport America. The window for that flight opens up in this coming week, December 11th. Of course, not all the news has been good lately from Spaceport America. A recent audit has raised serious questions about a policy approved by the New Mexico legislature to shield information involving Spaceport America. Some thoughts now from commentator Walt Rubel.
Senator John Arthur Smith told me several years ago that he was sold on the potential for Spaceport America after hearing space industry executives gush about the possibility to conduct secretive testing and research in the remote New Mexico desert. In the hyper-competitive private space industry, secrecy is a selling point for recruiters looking to lure more businesses to the spaceport. But for those concerned about government transparency and accountability, that same secrecy is a sticking point. In 2017, officials at Spaceport America convinced New Mexico legislators to shield companies doing business at the spaceport from the state's open records law. Those companies will go to states like Virginia, Texas, or California that have passed shield laws. If we don't, Spaceport CEO Dan Hicks warned at the time. Even things like the cost or length of a lease agreement had to be kept secret, because that information would be a tell to the industry, Hicks said. Desperate not to see their $220 million investment overtaken by the weeds of Sierra County, lawmakers went along with the plan. Now, it looks like that was a mistake. Investigations by the private firm McCard Accounting and the state auditor's office have uncovered a string of alleged abuses and violations at the spaceport. Hicks allegedly took unnecessary trips at state expense and then fudged the records. Circumvented the hiring process to offer jobs to people he had previous relationships with, lied about the existence of a strategic plan, intercepted his staff's email, and committed numerous violations of purchasing and contracting rules without the approval of the New Mexico Spaceport Authority Board. Former NMSA Board Chairman Rick Holdridge is faulted for a lack of oversight. The audit reports that there was literally a rubber stamp available for whenever Holdridge's signature was needed. All of this comes at a precarious time for the spaceport. Senator Smith, who had been able to protect spaceport funding in the past as chairman of the Finance Committee, won't be there anymore. He'll be replaced by Crystal Diamond, a Republican who said she's open to the idea of selling the spaceport. Diamond, a resident of Sierra County, said she appreciates the potential value of the spaceport, but believes that potential may never be reached as long as the state government is in charge. I fear she may be right. The spaceport was Bill Richardson's vision, but it has suffered from disinterest and neglect in the years since Richardson's left. Virgin Galactic is about ready to start launches. Business at the spaceport will pick up quickly when they do. The state needs to be prepared to take advantage of this opportunity that we've waited for so long. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's columns appear in the local viewpoint section at krwg.org. His opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of KRWG or NMSU. Back in March, the StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative visited Las Cruces. Every week, we are presenting portions of the interviews conducted during that visit. Today, Alvin Busby, a Vietnam veteran, is interviewed by his friend, Brenda Purcell.
At that time, the counselors at the various schools that I had gone to had told me that I had no hopes, no way that I could obtain a higher education. Mm-hmm. I decided I'm going to go into the military because the military has benefits that one can utilize to go back to school with. The second was to get away from my overbearing mother. She ruled the roost and everything like that. And if you didn't abide by her rules and all that, it was, you know. And the third was, you know, I wanted to meet different people, different cultures.
Well, and coming from like all that. These small towns, it gave you a way to see the world. You know how the commercials mm-hmm. always say you see the world?
Yes.
Well,
yes. And it also helped me with my social skills mm-hmm. because at that time I was totally social inept. I did not have any type of social skills or anything like that. And being in the military, it helped me with my social skills. I went back into the military for another 8 years, and I applied myself much better this time, advanced in rank and everything like that.
Because you were finally an adult.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, things were looking great and everything like that. And after those 8 years and everything like that, my wife came up to me and she goes, you know, I am, myself and the kids, we're sick and tired of every 2 years packing up and moving to somewhere else and everything like that. Can you please just get out? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, if that's the way you feel about it, if that's the way you want to do it and everything like that, okay, I'll abide by your
wishes. So when you got out, how did you fit in regular society outside in the military?
It was kind of rough at first. We finally moved back here because of circumstances surrounding my mother and everything like that. And I was here to take care of my mother and everything like that.
Tell me how you became a bus driver.
I moved back here in 2001. And I needed employment and everything like that. And I was going around and somebody said, you know, you'd be a perfect fit to be a bus driver because you were driving trucks at one time. So I went down, I applied, and I got hired. Mm-hmm. And, I thought I couldn't deal with those kids. But, you know, it worked out. And then, life took another turn for the worse. My mother passed away, and, it was devastating there for a while. I thought I was going to lose it there for a while. And my doctor at that time, she said, you know, I think the best medicine for you would be for you to go back to work. I said, yeah, but it's only been 3-4 days. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they'd want me to get back at work at all. And they said, well, give it a shot. So I went back to work. My supervisor and the person in charge of the routes, they were kind of shocked. And they go, we're going to put you on a different route. We think you can handle this because of what you're going through and everything like that. And it turned out to be one of the best routes that I could have been put on. The kids were fantastic. They were great. And for some reason or another, they could sense what I was going through. And they even talked with me about what's going on. We talked back and forth and everything like that. And when I was doing all this, I put myself as a company man. I never, you know, really listened to the kids and everything like that until after my mother passed away and I was put on this one route. And then all of a sudden, I started listening to the kids and listening to what they had to say and going, wow, they've got just as many problems as I do.
Exactly.
So I started helping them out, and it was the best medicine that I ever had.
Vietnam vet Alvin Busby. Funding for this segment by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for residents accepting admission in their 3 sanitized houses, 525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, this is KRWG Las Cruces and KRXG Silver City. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.